everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. And today we're going to be talking about pain to a certain extent. We're going to be talking about, you know, where does pain come from? Why do we feel it? Why does it register in our brain? And to talk about this is a professor from the Columbia School of Medicine in New York, Dr. Amy McDermott, and she's a professor in both the Department of Physiology and in Neuroscience. So, Amy McDermott, welcome to Science Studio.
Oh, well, thank you. It's a pleasure being here.
Before we get into pain and synapses and all this good stuff, let's talk a little bit about Amy. How did you get into being a scientist? What were those little moments that you can look back on and say, boy, a path was taken, or at least a path was revealed?
Well, I'd have to say it was biology in high school, and we had what was a new way of teaching biology at the time, which was the emphasis was more on how to make a hypothesis, how to design an experiment, and they had wonderful examples of studies, or not studies, but investigations people made, you know, hundreds of years ago, but they completely left out the controls. So their interpretation of what they were seeing was just crazy because they, you know, for example, they take a box and put a dirty shirt in it and leave it in the a barn overnight, and they'd come back and there'd evidence of rats being there. So they thought somehow the rat was generated out of the shirt, and they hadn't thought through their experimental protocol very well. Anyway, this general approach to biology.
Is that just something you made up?
No, that was actually in my textbook at the time, that example. It was an example of
materializing inside the box.
Spontaneous generation.
I thought of the cat in the box, but spontaneous generation, yes, of rats by shirts.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
That made sense to me. They have to do the control experiment. I got it. And that was the beginning of when I really got interested. I thought, I can think like this. This works for me.
Did you go home and take one of your father's shirts and put it in a box and keep looking at it from day in and day out? No?
No, I didn't.
Okay. So your parents were – I mean, did you do any experiments at home? I mean, clearly, you know, you're thinking about experiments, protocols, justifications. Did you actually do anything at home?
Not a designed experiment, no. I believe that's the way I thought about things, but I don't remember going out of my way to say, this is an experiment, I'm going to test this thing.
You know? All right. Now, did you in school then have to design your own experiments?
Yes, we did. And really looking back, I'd have to say that my senior thesis in high school was not a well-designed experiment, despite my interest in doing well-designed experiments. But I learned some things. I learned how to do chromatography. So we squished up Drosophila and looked at eyes in particular and looked at the pigments in them and saw them separate out.
Drosophila, the famous fruit fly.
The famous fruit fly,
right.
Yes.
Did you actually separate the eyes specifically and then grind them up?
Yes, and then run out. Using chromatography, using a solvent running through paper, we were able to get the different elements of the eye pigment there. But there wasn't really an experiment. There wasn't time to get – after we got all of that working, there wasn't time to try to compare different flies mutations and things.
But it was a lovely demonstration to a high school student about the power of experiment and analysis. I mean, even if you didn't know at the end what you were looking at with the different bands,
yeah.
I mean, this is quite a nice experiment.
Yeah.
And so this was in Vermont, I believe, correct?
We're talking high school here.
Yes.
So in high school, I was in Los Angeles at the time, living in Los Angeles.
And, okay.
Yeah.
And so then this particular experiment sounds quite sophisticated for high school, I must say. And the whole idea of writing a senior thesis – I mean, we do that in universities. I didn't know. Do people still do that in high school?
I guess some people do. I think so. Yeah.
Did all of the students have to do that?
Or I don't think it's – it's not a typical requirement. It's if you've got a special interest and you want to take advanced placement and go to a higher level, then you can do something like that.
And so you volunteered and clearly, yes, then the die was cast.
Yes, that's correct. That's when I
– And you get any of your interest in science from your parents, for example?
Yeah, maybe it's genetic. My father was a chemist by training, and my mother also learned chemistry, was a chemistry major in college. And in fact, as my mother likes to put it, they met over a test tube working for DuPont in the laboratory there back in the 40s.
Now, that was a time when, in fact, there was a need for recruiting females into the workforce, rather as we're trying to do today.
Absolutely. It was a very aggressive recruitment. It hadn't been done before. She was the first female chemist hired by the DuPont company down in West Virginia at their big chemical plant. They came up north to look for her, and the reason being that a lot of the men were going off to fight World War II.
Right.
And she felt that by going to work for DuPont, among other things, she was contributing to the war effort.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you see these old posters of Rosie the Riveter, but I've never seen Candace the Chemist.
No.
Well, maybe we've missed out on something on this.
Yes.
Because there were a whole range of jobs that the females had to do because there wasn't enough male manpower, I guess is the word, right?
Yeah. And it probably accelerated the acceptance of women in science, that whole process. I mean, it wasn't magical, but it was a beginning.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, the same thing in the air business. You know, the ladies that were ferrying airplanes across the country, across the ocean even, to join in the war effort. That's a fascinating piece of history in there that is beyond the scope of this program. But anyway, so two chemists over a test tube, and out comes Amy.
That's right.
This is pretty good.
Yeah.
Brothers and sisters?
I've got four sisters. They were very successful at creating the next generation.
All right.
Yeah.
And do they all have interest in science, or are you the sole outlier?
I am an outlier with that crowd, yes. The next closest is one of my sisters who's a speech pathologist, but then it just gets more and more divergent from there.
Okay. So you're in the Department of Physiology and you're in the Department of Neuroscience. Let's start with first of explaining what, for the lay listener and myself, physiology. Tell us very in a nutshell, what is physiology and what do people study in physiology?
Yeah, physiology is how things work in a biological system, how they function. For example, my interest is in neuroscience, and you can look at a piece of brain tissue or spinal cord tissue and figure out where the cells are, but you have no idea how they're actually interacting with each other. And physiology is the study of how they act on a millisecond-by-millisecond basis. You can see how they're functioning, how they talk to each other, how they transduce signals, how they send signals from the skin, let's say, up to the brain. All of that is physiology. It's function.
Okay. And then the other department, neuroscience, means that you're simply using physiological concepts and attitudes and studies to look at the brain?
Generally, that's what neuroscience is. My particular focus is in the spinal cord. We are looking at pathways that are involved in pain signaling that come into the spinal cord. They get processed there by the circuitry. That's what we're studying. And then if it's a strong enough signal, the signal goes up to the brain and you say, ouch, something hurts.
So in fact then, just so I got that clear, whenever I do something to my feet or my leg or my hip, the signal eventually has to get to the spinal column for transmission up to the brain.
Right.
Without the spinal column, you wouldn't feel any pain.
That's correct.
Right. You wouldn't feel any sensation at all then, presumably.
That's correct too, yes.
Right. So the spinal cord is then the real conduit of pain signals.
Yes. And for pain, it is way more than just a conduit. It's very interesting about the pain pathways because what happens to the signaling in the spinal cord can make the difference of whether you feel much pain or you don't. So there's an entire circuitry in the brain that actually projects neurons down to where the pain signals come in and can shut it down or let it go through. So the body itself has a way of tightly regulating pain right at the level of the spinal cord, interestingly.
So in fact, now that's interesting. So when you say you've got a pain somewhere, but over time, that pain seems to, you don't think about it and it's almost not there. Is that because the brain is sending down, you know, like blotting paper down there to sort of quench the signal, or is that – am I talking rubbish?
Well, that could be certainly contributing. Probably also a lot of that is cortical, where your brain is saying, look, you really got to be focusing on, you know, this radio show, or you really got to be focusing on this other thing. And it takes your attention away from the pain that was bothering you when you didn't have anything else to think about. The pain is very prominent.
So pain can overload the brain.
Oh, it can.
Or other things can overload the brain to shut out the pain.
Yeah.
So when you're in pain, then the idea is you should go and do something or read a book or listen to a piece of music. I mean, is this a simple-minded therapy?
Well, I think if you can have something, I would say a very loud movie might be more effective, something that really grabs your brain. I think the classic example of this kind of thing is soldiers on the battlefield. So if they sustain a bad injury, but they're in a life-threatening situation, they may not even know they were hurt. That they could take an injury, not even know it, because they have to press on. They have to get out of there or something worse will happen. And then they get to a safe place, and all of a sudden they realize that there's a tremendous pain. And that is probably a good example of this descending regulatory system. It just shuts it down because there's no value to worrying about the pain where you just got shot if you're going to get shot a whole lot more if you don't get the heck out of there, kind of thing.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
So the brain really is a very sophisticated, well, I mean, we know this, but it's just another reinforcement that the brain is a very sophisticated business, right?
Yeah.
And now there's a lot more emphasis on neuroscience, right? I mean, I think the federal government or an Obama plan to sort of put more funding or more attention into the brain. I mean, is this something that you're beginning to see an impact, or is it too soon to see where that particular thrust is going?
Well, I think it's too soon to really see impact, but it's very actively being pursued in many places, including my institution, where people are trying very hard to go after defining what used to be thought to be completely impossible, defining all of the connections in the brain, which is sort of mind-boggling, but that's the goal. And the imaging techniques that are becoming more available is making that actually possible to do.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Professor Amy McDermott from the Columbia School of Medicine in New York, and we'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Neisel. About one out of every 10 Americans now has diabetes. Expect to add at least 1.5 million cases each year because that's the trajectory of this disease.
So finding a cure is a priority since the price tag of treating diabetes is $250 billion a year. Not because the cost to treat each patient is skyrocketing, it's due to the sheer number of diabetics.
One promising treatment uses stem cell technology and eliminated diabetes in mice in 40 days. Researchers developed insulin-producing cells called S7 from human embryonic stem cells. These S7 cells produce insulin and regulate the level of glucose in the blood.
The upsides to this treatment are many. For one, you remove the diabetic's burden of insulin injections to modulate their blood sugar, which is often challenging. And this beats pancreatic transplants, which are in short supply and require immunosuppressant drugs.
The supply of S7 would potentially be sustainable since they're produced from stem cells. The downside is they're derived from embryonic stem cells, which faces ethical challenges. The researchers claim they can switch to adult stem cells, but that remains to be proven.
One challenge is S7 cells react slower to glucose than natural beta cells, which normally do the job in our bodies. S7 cells also do not make as much insulin. Both these issues are now being tackled.
Another challenge is making S7 work for both type 1 and 2 diabetes. Most likely, it won't work for type 1 diabetics whose immune systems attack insulin-producing cells and could theoretically do the same to S7s.
For now, they appear to work best for type 2 diabetes, at least in mice. That's why it's premature to call this a cure, but it's a big step forward.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell, and I'm with Professor Amy McDermott from the Department of Physiology and from the Department of Neuroscience at the Columbia Medical Center in New York. We were talking about pain and the clever tricks that the brain can do to send signals down to your spinal cord to stop the pain right there, or at least stop the signal of the pain right there. Let's just talk about pain for a moment, because some people can tolerate pain better than others, so I'm told. Some people, you know, on a scale of 10, what's your headache like? Oh, it's 10. Others will say it's 2. I mean, it's very subjective. But, you know, pain, we all know what pain is. You stub your foot, you hit your head, you prick your finger. There's all sorts of different types of pain. And whereas pain may be difficult to define, tell us a little bit about different types of pain. What you should really pay attention to, perhaps what you shouldn't necessarily pay attention to. Is that a viable question?
It certainly is. And in the field, people think of pain in three different categories. I think many of us can relate to them in a practical, personal way. There's acute pain. That's when you hit your finger with a hammer or stub your toe, or
usually accompanied by some words.
Yes, some words. And there's persistent pain. That's pain that usually is associated with inflammation. For example, if you have arthritis in your knee, or you have Lyme's disease or something like that, you have something generating a pain signal telling you it hurts. And then there's chronic pain. And typically chronic pain, especially pain that's called neuropathic pain or pain that's associated with nerve injury, is usually no longer associated with an actual injury. So the injury recovers. Let's say you cut a nerve in your arm. It all recovers. Everything's fine. 2 years later, you may still have tremendous pain in that area, and that's called neuropathic pain. And that's an area of great interest in the field. It's not well treated medically. There aren't really great drugs for treating neuropathic pain. And yet it's a seriously debilitating problem. People with spinal cord injury, something like 60% of people with spinal cord injury have neuropathic pain just constantly. So the understanding of how that works is not clear yet, but something's changed in your spinal cord or in your brain or both and is generating pain signals, even though nothing's actually hurting you in your body anymore.
But the brain isn't clever enough to send down the little messengers to say, hey, stop sending up this pain signal.
No, it thinks it's the real deal. Your brain thinks it's getting the true signal. And what's happened in many cases is your spinal cord has gotten hyperexcited, and it's just sending inappropriate signals to the brain saying, you know, the pain pathway is active. It's active. And the brain thinks, okay, you know, that's it. I've got a pain. But there is nothing causing it. It's just the spinal cord giving an inappropriate signal.
I mean, it's the same, at least to my imagination, it's the same as what I read about people with phantom limbs. You know, they've had an arm amputated, but they sense that they've still got fingers. I mean, is it a similar related concept or no?
It absolutely is. It's another very good example. And in fact, a lot of people have phantom limb pain. So they can have, let's say somebody loses part of their arm, their hand's gone, but they could have tremendous pain in their thumb, even though their thumb isn't even there. So clearly it's going to be difficult to treat that. It's not anywhere that exists on your body anymore, and yet you have the distinct sensation that your thumb or your hand or something that isn't part of your body anymore hurts a lot.
Is it always sensible and appropriate to treat pain with a drug to stop the pain? I mean, it's a great temptation, I'm sure.
Well, in the case of something like phantom limb pain,
right,
absolutely. I mean, there's just no reason anybody should have to live like that. If there would be a way to treat it, you treat it. It is a problem, though. You have to be careful because the pain pathway, it provides a good service to all of us. That helps us learn what's damaging to the body. It helps you learn as a child what fire is, what is bad for you. So acute pain, the initial injuries, those are important. And so is persistent pain. If you break your arm, you've got to be careful of it for a while. So those continuous pain signals are saying, don't let anything touch this arm for a while. It's still on the mend, that kind of thing.
Let's go back to something that you got into, and that is, okay, the brain is full of connectivities, all right? I mean, to understand the human condition, to put it on a high level, we would like to know all these connectivities in the brain. And this is one of your interests, I think?
Sure.
Yeah, so how are you beginning to sort of map out the connectivities? And what do you see as the sort of the golden fleece at the end of this?
Well, there is this movement which is supported by the White House and NIH to really find out about brain connectivity in a way no one's ever imagined before. And I think that has great value, that approach. And one analogy to that is, you know, years ago when the Human Genome Project was going and the government put a lot of resources for biomedical research into the Human Genome Project to clone all the genes in the human body. And people said, well, this is just pointless. What are you doing this for? Nobody knows what half those genes do. And, of course, in the end, that was the point. Now, investigation of human diseases and how to treat them has been enormously accelerated by the Human Genome Project. Nobody has to discover for the first time some gene. They're all out there. You just got to find which one it is. And it's much faster when you already know what everything is. So that's the idea with this new brain connectivity project, which is it seems like it's almost too much information to know how every neuron is connected to every other neuron in the brain. But I think it will provide tremendous insights into brain function. If you realize that one area is connected to another area, no one even knew that before. But not only that, you know that one area is talking to the other area, but it's only talking to one small part of it, and it's only talking to parts of that brain that are inhibitory. It's going to be completely different. It's going to be a drive that's going to shut down that area of the brain.
Is it appropriate, the way I think about the brain, as just myriad of connectivities that you can, in fact, go from any part of the brain to another part of the brain through a series of connectivities, right? But they're not always open. They open and they close. I mean, is that a fair way of looking at it? It's not like a maze where you can go down a circuit and you come to a dead end, all right, and then you've got to back off. That there is a way to get through that dead end, but we don't know necessarily what those triggers are. Is that an appropriate way to think about connectivity in the brain?
Well, I think that is partially an appropriate way. I think there are probably many undiscovered connections that will make it seem something very like that. But if you think about how we move, for example, ultimately the brain has got to talk to the spinal cord and it's got to talk to your muscles. That's the end. That's the end of the line for movement. So the whole pattern of movement is generated up there, but it goes to the end of the line down at the muscles.
Interesting. Specifically now, what is it that you and your research group are really focusing on?
Well, we are interested in a particular type of neuropathic pain called allodynia.
Allodynia?
Allodynia. And that is when somebody who has allodynia, a gentle touch in the area where they're allodynic creates pain.
Sounds like a gouty condition to
me. That could generate allodynia. So what's interesting about that to us is that it says that there is some way in which the touch system, which is unique, it's separate from the pain system, but there's some way that the wiring from the touch system is getting to the pain output system. And so that idea has really motivated probably the last 10 years of our work, is to find out how that could happen and how to control it.
It's like a leakage from one system to another?
Yes, an inappropriate leakage. It's
right.
One that is, you know, painful.
So how do you study it, and what have you discovered?
Well, the very first question we asked was whether the touch fibers, the ones out in your skin, in your hands, in your feet, that sense touch, are able to talk directly to the pain pathway under some conditions, and they don't.
How do you know that? What's the experiment?
So the experiment is that we know, we work on slices of spinal cord, and we know how to stimulate the touch fibers, and we have a way of finding the pain output fibers in the spinal cord. So if we record from the pain output fibers and we stimulate the touch fibers, there is no direct connection.
This is with real people?
This is with tissue, animal tissue.
Animal tissue.
Mouse, rodent tissue. And then we found out that if we put on drugs that block inhibition, so in the nervous system, there's excitation and inhibition. They have to be in the right balance. If we prevent the inhibition from functioning properly, then we find that the touch fibers can talk to the pain output neurons.
So there is a gate.
There's a gate.
Yes. Okay.
Absolutely. And so we've been looking at that inhibitory system for the last 5 years or so.
What's the biggest surprise you found, or was the gate the big surprise?
Well, the gate, it wasn't a surprise, but we predicted it, and it was actually there. That was a very happy surprise.
Did you go out for a drink on
yeah,
that day, right?
Yeah, sure. Why not?
Yeah.
We were very pleased with that, and I think that in its own little way was a significantly helpful contribution to the field, because people are now looking using genetic approaches to identify all of the little excitatory interneurons and all of the inhibitory neurons that are explicitly involved in that system.
Okay, well, we've almost come to the end, but I think just touching on the celebration, tell the audience how you and your group celebrate a really interesting new finding. I mean, do you have a regular way of saying, oh, that was a great result, let's go out and have Chinese food or go for a marathon? I mean, is there anything that you do as a group when you get a good result like that?
To be honest with you, no. Our celebrations focus around papers being published, accepted for publication,
right,
and grants being won. Then we pop open champagne.
Okay. Well, so the real champagne is with the paper or with the funding?
Both.
Both.
They're treated equally.
Okay. Well, that's great. And, of course, one can't happen without the other, I mean, unfortunately. But I think we've come to the end of a science studio. Amy McDermott from the Columbia College of Medicine, from the Department of Physiology and Neuroscience. It's been a great pleasure talking to you. I mean, I really enjoyed this, and I've learned a lot. And anytime you're down in this region again, come on by, and we'll find out what the latest results are.
Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure.
And Norma Martinez, as always, thank you for editing this, putting it together, and making it sound as wonderful as it will do. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with another Science Studio. Bye-bye.